A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about preparedness as a layering exercise. Not one grand gesture, but small improvements stacked over time. He's circling back to something we touched on in a previous episode about diplomatic signaling and embassy registration. His question this time is practical. If you're traveling to or through a volatile part of the world, what does a prudent pre-travel protocol actually look like? He wants to know the diplomatic landscape. What missions your country has, where they are, who they are, what their phone numbers are, and then the mechanics. How you gather that information, how you save it to your devices, and whether printed copies still make sense.
He's right to ask about the paper copies. Most people skip that step entirely.
So Daniel's question breaks down into three layers. What the diplomatic landscape looks like, how you plug into it, and how you keep that information alive when everything else fails.
Let's start with the landscape itself, because most people use the word embassy to mean everything, and that's not quite right. An embassy is the main diplomatic mission, always in the capital city. It's where the ambassador sits. It handles high-level diplomatic work, but it also runs the consular section. That's the part that actually serves citizens. Passports, notarials, emergency assistance.
Then the consulate.
A consulate is a branch office, usually in a major city that isn't the capital. So you've got the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, but consulates in Frankfurt and Munich. They do the same citizen services work, just at a smaller scale. The distinction matters because if you're in Hamburg and something happens, your nearest U.S. diplomatic post might be the consulate in Hamburg, not the embassy in Berlin. You need to know which one is closest to where you'll actually be.
And then there's the honorary consul, which sounds like a title from a 19th century novel.
It kind of is. An honorary consul is typically a local national, often a business person, who's been appointed to provide limited consular services on behalf of a foreign country. They're not career diplomats. They might be able to help with a lost passport or notarize a document, but in a genuine crisis they have very little capability. They don't have the secure communications, they don't have the staff, they don't have the evacuation infrastructure.
So the traveler's mental map needs to distinguish between the real thing and the ceremonial version.
And that's step one of the protocol. Before you book anything, you look up what your country actually has in the region. Not just, is there an embassy, but what kind of mission, where exactly, and what services it provides. The State Department's country information pages list all of this. Every other major country does the same through their foreign ministry websites. It's not hidden information, it's just that most people never look.
And the core insight is that diplomatic missions aren't interchangeable. An embassy in the capital is the coordination point in a crisis. A consulate in a secondary city handles routine services, but may not have the capacity to manage an evacuation. And an honorary consul probably can't do much beyond point you toward the embassy.
Right. And in a volatile region, the embassy is where the security infrastructure is. After the 1998 bombing in Nairobi, the U.S. radically changed how it builds and secures embassies. These are fortresses now, setback requirements, blast walls, marine security guards. The consulate might be in a shared office building with a single locked door. That difference in physical security posture becomes relevant if you're trying to reach them during an active crisis.
So knowing the landscape means knowing not just addresses, but capabilities. Now, let's talk about the mechanism that makes all of this work. The registration systems that flip the default from you finding the embassy to the embassy finding you.
The U.S. program is called STEP, the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program. It's free, it's run by the State Department, and it lets you register your trip details with the nearest embassy or consulate before you travel. You enter where you're going, when you'll be there, how to reach you, and any special circumstances.
And the name makes it sound like a tracking system, which it isn't.
That's the most common misconception. STEP isn't a tracking system. It doesn't monitor your location. What it does is create a communication channel. Without registration, the default is that you have to find the embassy when something goes wrong. With registration, the embassy can reach you. They can push security alerts, evacuation instructions, and departure window information directly to your email or phone.
Which matters enormously in a scenario where you don't have power or connectivity for long stretches. If the embassy sends an alert at 3 a.m. about a departure convoy leaving at 6 a.m., and you're registered, you might get that message in a brief window when your phone has signal. If you're not registered, you simply never hear about it.
The 2023 Sudan evacuation is the case study here. When the fighting broke out in Khartoum, the U.S. government used STEP registration data to identify citizens in the country and send them targeted alerts about departure options. The people who were registered got messages about where to go and when. The people who weren't registered were essentially invisible to the system.
And this isn't just a U.S. thing. The U.K. runs a program called Locate. Australia has DFAT registration through Smart Traveller. Canada has registration of Canadians abroad. The principle is universal, even if the specific portal differs. If your country offers it, you should use it.
The mechanism is worth understanding. When you register, your information goes into a consular database that populates what's called a warden list. Wardens are volunteer citizens, usually long-term residents or expats, who act as communication relays in a crisis. The embassy can push messages to wardens, who then try to reach the registered citizens in their geographic area. It's a distributed communication network that works even when the embassy's own phone lines are overwhelmed.
So registration isn't just adding your name to a spreadsheet. It's plugging into a pre-built communication architecture.
And the architecture fails if your contact details are stale. This is the part people get wrong. They register once, years ago, with an email address they no longer use and a phone number that's changed. That registration is functionally useless. Part of the pre-travel protocol is updating your STEP registration, or whatever your country's equivalent is, with current contact information for this specific trip.
How often do people actually update?
The State Department doesn't publish those numbers, but anecdotally, consular officers will tell you that a significant portion of registrations are years out of date. It's a set-it-and-forget-it problem.
So the protocol has a maintenance step built in. Register, then verify the registration is current before each trip. That's not complicated, but it's easy to skip.
Most of this protocol isn't complicated. That's what makes it interesting as an information architecture problem. None of these steps are hard, they're just specific, and they need to be done before you need them. The registration is the backbone. Now let's talk about what you actually carry.
So registration is the backbone. But the protocol doesn't end at the portal. It ends with what's in your pocket when the network goes dark.
The pre-travel protocol as an information architecture exercise. Before you leave, you compile a diplomatic contact sheet. This isn't just the embassy phone number. It's the embassy mainline, the consulate in your region of travel, the after-hours emergency line, which is often a completely different number, and the country-specific emergency number for where you're going, which is probably not 911.
The after-hours line is the one people miss. Embassies have a duty officer rotation. Someone is always reachable. But that number isn't the one on the website's contact page. It's typically buried in the emergency services section, and you have to go looking for it.
And then there's the Home Country Operations Center. For U.S. citizens, that's the State Department's Overseas Citizen Services. From inside the U.S. or Canada, it's 1-884-747-4747. From overseas, it's +1-202-501-4444. That second number is the one that matters when you're abroad. It's the direct line to the Operations Center in Washington, and it works even if the local embassy is unreachable.
Why would the local embassy be unreachable?
Phone lines get overwhelmed. In a mass casualty event or a coup, the embassy switchboard might be completely saturated, or the embassy itself might be temporarily closed. It happens. The Washington Ops Center is the alternate path. It's staffed 24/7, and they can relay messages to the local mission through diplomatic channels that don't depend on the public phone network.
So you've got at least three numbers: local embassy, after-hours duty officer, and the home country ops center. That's the minimum contact sheet.
And you save them to your phone's native contacts app, not a notes app, not a screenshot, not an email draft. The Contacts app works offline, it works with voice commands, and it doesn't require you to unlock your phone and navigate to a specific file. In a stressful situation, you want to be able to say, call embassy, and have it work.
The international dialing format matters too. If you save the number as a local number, just the digits without the country code, it might not work when you're roaming. You need the full format, plus country code, city code, number. Plus 1 to 202 to 51 to 4444, not just 202 to 51 to 4444.
And while we're on the device strategy, save the embassy's physical address to your Maps app for offline use. Download the map of the city you're visiting before you go. Google Maps and Apple Maps both support offline downloads. If the network is down, your phone's GPS still works, and you want to be able to navigate to the embassy without a data connection.
What about messaging apps? A lot of embassies now have WhatsApp or Signal numbers for emergency contact.
Some do, and it's worth checking. But don't rely on it as your primary channel. Messaging apps depend on data connectivity, and in a crisis, data networks are often the first thing to go, either through infrastructure damage or deliberate shutdown. Voice calls over the regular phone network are more resilient. SMS is even more resilient than that. The contact sheet should prioritize voice numbers.
Now the part Daniel specifically asked about. Paper copies.
Devices fail. Batteries die. Phones get confiscated at checkpoints. Networks go dark. In the 2015 Nepal earthquake, cell networks were down for days. Travelers who had paper contact sheets had a functional reference. Travelers who had everything on their phones had a dead rectangle.
The paper copy is the analog fallback that requires no power and no signal. It's not paranoia. It's acknowledging that the thing you're preparing for is precisely the scenario where your phone stops being useful.
The format matters. A laminated card in your wallet, credit card sized, with the key numbers. A full-size copy in your luggage, in a sealed plastic bag. And a copy left with a trusted person at home, along with your itinerary.
That last piece is the second-order layer. Sharing your itinerary and contact sheet with someone at home creates an external memory. If you can't communicate at all, that person can contact the embassy on your behalf and say, "My brother is in this city. He's staying at this hotel. Here's his passport number."
They should have your passport number. The contact sheet you leave at home should include your passport details, number, issue date, expiration date, issuing authority. If your passport is lost or stolen, that information speeds up the replacement process enormously. The embassy can verify your citizenship instantly instead of having to search records.
How much of this do you think the average traveler actually does?
Almost none of it. Most people show up at the airport with a passport and a phone and assume that's sufficient, and for most trips, it is. The protocol we're describing is for the edge case, the volatile region, the deteriorating security situation, the trip where the downside risk is genuinely high.
But the interesting thing is that the protocol isn't expensive or time-consuming. It's maybe an hour of work before a trip. The barrier isn't cost or complexity. It's that people don't think to do it.
There's one more piece I want to add, the pre-departure check. Before you go, verify the current travel advisory level for your destination. The State Department uses a four-level system. Level 1 is exercise normal precautions. Level 4 is don't travel. But the number alone isn't enough. Read the actual advisory text. It'll tell you which regions of the country are most dangerous, what the specific risks are, and whether the embassy has imposed movement restrictions on its own staff.
That last part is a signal worth paying attention to. If embassy personnel aren't allowed to travel outside the capital, that tells you something about the security environment.
Also confirm the embassy's physical location, not just the address, but where it sits in the city. Look at it on a satellite map. Identify a backup route to get there. If the main road is blocked by protests or checkpoints, what's your alternate path?
Check whether the mission has published any specific guidance for your region of travel. Some embassies put out security alerts for particular neighborhoods or provinces. That information is often in the STEP alerts or on the embassy's website, and it's more granular than the countrywide advisory.
All of this feeds into the same principle. You're building a personal information architecture before you need it. The time to figure out where the embassy is and how to reach it isn't when you hear gunfire.
That's the phrase that should be on the laminated card.
Before we wrap, Hilbert's been sitting on something, and I have a feeling it's not just the mangoes.
I worked at the embassy in Nairobi, late 90s, consular assistant, Got the job through a friend of a friend, kept it 11 months.
11 months.
There was an incident with a diplomatic pouch and a mislabeled crate of mangoes. I was asked to leave. It's not relevant.
Wait, what was in the crate?
Mangoes. That was the problem. They were supposed to be documents. But that's not what I came out to say.
Of course it isn't.
You've covered the numbers and the registration. That's all correct. But the thing that actually matters, and I watched this play out more than once, is the last 200 meters. You've got your laminated card, you've got the address, you've found the embassy on the map. But when you get there, there's an outer security cordon. In Nairobi, after the bombing, that cordon was serious. Concrete barriers, armed guards, a holding area. The challenge wasn't reaching the embassy, it was getting to the gate.
What determined whether someone got through?
Documents. Passport, specifically. I watched a man show up during a civil unrest situation. He had a laminated contact card, very well organized, all the numbers. The card got him past the first checkpoint because the guards recognized the embassy logo he'd printed on it. But at the second checkpoint, they wanted his passport. He didn't have it. Left it at his hotel.
Did he get in?
Eventually. Took about 4 hours. Someone had to go to the hotel with him. During those 4 hours, the evacuation convoy he was trying to catch left without him.
The contact sheet is the start, not the end.
The passport is the thing that proves you're who you say you are. Everything else is supplementary. I'd add to your protocol, know where the secure waiting area is relative to the embassy entrance, know what documents you need to present at each checkpoint, and don't assume the guards speak your language. In Nairobi, the outer perimeter was staffed by local security contractors. Some spoke English, some didn't. If you showed up speaking only English, and the guard on duty that day spoke only Swahili, you had a problem.
What solved that problem?
The laminated card, actually. If it had the embassy's name and address in the local language, you could point to it. The man with the card, that part worked. It was the passport he was missing.
Your recommendation is contact sheet in the local language, passport on your person at all times, and a plan for the last 200 meters.
Don't put mangoes in a diplomatic pouch. But that's a separate protocol.
I have so many questions about the mangoes.
Most people do.
That last 200 meters point is exactly the kind of detail that doesn't show up in the State Department guidance. The official materials tell you the address and the phone number. They don't tell you there's a holding area on the east side of the compound, or that the guard at the second gate needs to see your passport, or that the person at the first gate might not speak your language.
That knowledge is perishable. Security postures change. The embassy might move the checkpoint, or change the contractor, or modify the entry procedures. Part of the pre-travel protocol should be checking for any recent embassy security notices that describe the current access procedures.
Which brings us to the edge case Daniel didn't ask about, but that's worth leaving on the table. What does this protocol look like when you're traveling to a region where your country has no diplomatic presence at all? The nearest mission is in a neighboring country.
That changes the math significantly. If there's no U.S. embassy in the country you're visiting, the nearest embassy, usually in an adjacent country, is your point of contact. But that embassy may have limited ability to help you inside a country where it has no presence. You're relying on what's called a protecting power arrangement, another country's embassy that's agreed to provide limited consular services to your country's citizens.
Which means you need to know which country is your protecting power, where their embassy is, and what services they can actually provide.
That information changes. Protecting power arrangements shift with diplomatic relations. It's not something you can assume from one trip to the next.
The other thing worth watching is how registration data shapes crisis response over time. As more countries digitize their registration systems, the gap between citizens who register and those who don't becomes a measurable factor in evacuation planning. The data determines where resources get deployed. If the embassy knows there are 200 registered citizens in a particular city, they plan for 200. If you're not registered, you're not in the denominator.
That's already happening. In the Sudan evacuation, the U.S. government was explicit that step registration data was used to identify concentrations of citizens and plan departure routes. The system is designed around the people who've opted in.
The practical takeaway here isn't complicated. Know what missions your country has and what they can actually do. Register before you go and keep your details current. Build a contact sheet with the embassy, the after-hours line, and the home country ops center in international dialing format. Save it to your contacts app, download offline maps, and print a laminated copy. Share everything with someone at home. Carry your passport. Know the last 200 meters.
Don't put mangoes in a diplomatic pouch.
That one's more situational.
Preparedness in this context isn't about fear. It's about making the system work for you before you need it. The system exists. The registration portals exist. The emergency numbers exist. The gap isn't in the infrastructure. It's in the connection between the traveler and the infrastructure.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumintop for producing, and for the mango-related cautionary tale we'll absolutely be revisiting.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.